Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
Among all the possible choices, I decided that the most serious and universal problem is a growing chasm between the richest and poorest people on Earth. It's interesting to note that citizens of the 10 wealthiest countries are now 75 times richer than those who live in the 10 poorest ones. And the separation is increasing every year, not only between nations, but within them. The results of this disparity are the root causes of most of the world's unresolved problems, including starvation, illiteracy, environmental degradation, violent conflict, and unnecessary illnesses that range from guinea worm to HIV and AIDS.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Curtain podcast. I'm Paul Listick. And that speech, of course, I know you recognize the voice, former President Jimmy Carter. It sounds like for the most part, that speech could be given today. But it was his acceptance speech back in 2002 when he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And if you know a lot about Jimmy Carter, or more likely, if you don't, there's a brand new book that has just come out. I can't imagine a more definitive biography ever being written. It is called His Very Best: Jimmy Carter, A Life, and it is written by very well-known award-winning author and columnist and filmmaker Jonathan Alter. New York Times bestsellers, three of them. That's three more than I have. And anyway, Jonathan, it's an honor to have you on the podcast, and thanks for joining me to talk about the book.
I'm really glad to be here, Paul. Thanks for having me.
So, Jonathan Alter, in this incredible book, one of the things that I think may surprise people, everybody always assumes that his real name was James Carter, but yet a lot of people think it's Jimmy. The truth is, there was a special notation on his birth certificate made by his mom about that, right?
That's right. He was born James Earl Carter Jr., but Lillian Carter's mother scrawled on his birth record, and I saw this at the Carter Library, Jimmy now, but later, of course, it will be Jim. And it never was. It was always Jimmy as his nickname. And then when he first ran for office in 1962, there were some people who said, well, why don't you use James on the ballot? And a good friend of his said, no, use Jimmy. That's a better name on the ballot. So he did.
And I you wrote about that. You take it all the way back to that birth certificate and all of that. So this is an incredibly comprehensive book. So the obvious question to start off with, over 600 pages on the life of Jimmy Carter. Fortunately, he's still with us, still around. What led you to say it was time for Jimmy Carter to get the definitive biography written about him?
Well, there was just a huge hole in the line of scrimmage. I mean, you just look at his contemporaries, Ronald Reagan and Ted Kennedy. They've each had a half dozen biographies that have been written about them, and another one on Kennedy is coming out soon. And Carter hadn't had any. You know, his aides had written books, but not by an independent historian. And then, a couple of things happened to me as I was thinking about doing this. First, I got familiar with the Camp David Accords, and just the virtuoso performance of Carter there when he basically brought peace between Israel and Egypt after 30 years of constant war, and they haven't shot a fire shot in anger in the 40 years since. And I just thought, you know, this is the most durable and major peace treaty since World War II. And that suggests there's got to be more to the Carter story than failed president, great ex-president. Now, when I started to look into his life, I realized his life is like a novel. I mean, it's a true American epic, from barefoot boy with no electricity or running water to, you know, citizen of the world, global humanitarian, with an awful lot in between. And then finally, it turned out that my editor at Simon & Schuster, my publisher, is also Jimmy Carter's editor. And so she, Alice Mayhew was her name, she died earlier this year, she got very excited about this. And, of course, she smoothed the way for me. So I had a huge amount of access to Jimmy and Rosalind Carter and their entire family. And, you know, I was in their home and more than once, and I built a house with them in Memphis for Habitat for Humanity. I went back to Jimmy's reunion at the Naval Academy and interviewed him more than a dozen times. So this just, you know, it all kind of came together for me when I found that the world also was aching for some sense of decency. And Carter's story was a great relief for me in the last 5 years from Donald Trump. And I'm hoping that it's going to be sort of what you might call comfort food for the body politic to read about an honest, decent president for all of his flaws.
Indeed, you write about him as disciplined and incorruptible, and I think correct me if I'm wrong, John, but if you were to ask a lot of people, like, what one word would describe Jimmy Carter, I think a lot of people who don't know any better would say that he was weak. And in fact, you asked Carter what the biggest myth about him was, and his answer was
that he was weak. And it is a myth, because anybody who knew him and knows him now knows how tough he really is. And, you know, I have a chapter about his time as governor where it was called Jungle Jimmy. And beneath the nice smile and the cardigan sweater is a very intense guy. When I asked his son he has three sons, but when I asked his son Jeff for the word that best described him, he said intense. And I think that's actually right. And he was seen as weak because he was kind of swamped in the last 2 years of his presidency by external events, a bad economy, the Iran hostage crisis, Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And he refused to respond in a warlike fashion because he really is a peacemaker. And that grows out of his religious faith. But he could convey the impression that he was weak, and that really, really cost him. It was an erroneous impression for a lot of reasons that I explained, but it was real, and it helped cost him re-election in 1980.
Well, and for one thing, you write that so much of what Carter did, Reagan got credit for. I'm going to come back to that, but I found it interesting that you talked about Carter's love for Harry Truman, who, of course, you know, if ever there was the mole of a president who was unpopular but became more popular in time, it might have been Truman. But I'm going to kind of, that's at the beginning of the book, and at the end of the book, you talk about the fact that Carter is not exactly a favored member of the ex-president's club. But here's what I didn't know, that I didn't know so much of the book, but that he was good with a lot of his predecessors, but of the successors, he really has gotten along with the Republicans more than the Democrats, and that even included Trump for the first couple of years. That's what you write.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he didn't spend a lot of time with any of them, but he, you know, his predecessors, his living predecessors were Nixon and Ford. And Nixon, he invited to the White House when he had the state dinner for Deng Xiaoping, when they, you know, established diplomatic relations. And that, of course, I shouldn't say of course, because few people know this, but Carter recognizing China is the basis for the global economy of today, that bilateral relationship for all of the troubles it has is the foundation of the global economy. And at that time, China had the GDP of sub-Saharan Africa, you know, and think about how much has changed. But he invited Nixon to that state dinner, and he even invited him to his inauguration, which fortunately for the Democrats, they were relieved when he didn't show up. And then he was very close to Ford, who he had beaten in 76. Together, they did a number of projects as former president. But he had real issues, especially with Bill Clinton, where his ego sometimes got in the way, and he became kind of a freelance secretary of state. And when he would go on these very successful peacekeeping missions for Clinton and Haiti and North Korea, when he came back, he would go on CNN before he reported to the president, which caused a lot of bad feeling. And he had a good relationship with George H.W. Bush until, on the eve of the Gulf War, he writes other heads of state privately urging them to vote against the United States and the United Nations, which, you know, Bush, who I interviewed not long before he died, considered kind of unforgivable. You know, he had a lot of respect for Carter, and he called him a good man. But he, you know, as he said to me, we only have one president at a time. And then with Obama, I think they basically did not have much of a relationship. And I also interviewed Obama, who said very nice things about Carter's contributions, even though Carter's feelings were hurt that Obama hadn't spent more time with him. And Carter was felt free to criticize Obama and his drone policy and other things. Carter has never censored himself when it came to expressing his opinion. With Trump, he was angling to get appointed envoy in his 90s to North Korea because he had a lot of experience there. And so he was kind of pulling his punches a little bit on Trump. He told me that he didn't like the fact that he lied a lot, but he wasn't willing to give up on him and, you know, wanted to help him with China and other issues. But once Trump went to North Korea himself and the chances of Carter returning to the spotlight faded, then he really let loose on Trump over the cages at the Mexican border. And more recently, his mismanagement of the pandemic, which, you know, Carter is the un-Trump in so many ways. I think the obvious ones are honesty, decency, and integrity. But, you know, one of the other ways that he's the un-Trump is he was a planner. He created FEMA. In addition to creating the Departments of Education and Energy, he did all of this emergency planning as president. And so for him, just the rank incompetence of Trump's response to this pandemic has been really disturbing. And then, of course, he's gone around the world monitoring elections and promoting democracy. So Trump's assaults on democracy have been very troubling to him. And he and Rosalynn were strong supporters of Biden at the convention and in the weeks since.
Just chapter 15, it's part of part three of the book, and chapter 15 is called Jimmy Who. And I've got to tell you, because it is true, he's one of the, maybe Bill Clinton is one of them too. They kind of come out of nowhere to this national presence. You write a lot about that. I remember meeting Carter. Actually, I was at a leadership program when I was in high school, and they said the governor of Georgia is coming through, and nobody heard of him. Nobody knew who he was, but he shook hands and met everybody. And it was almost as though, I think you write about 5 months after becoming governor back in 71, he wants to go national. He goes national. How did all that happen? Did he always know he was going to be a big deal?
No, his ambition when he was a boy was to go to the Naval Academy. And then in the 50s, and this to me was a fascinating part of his life. So he goes, you know, he's a door-to-door missionary in 1968 as he's born again. He goes through that experience. And he had lost in 1966 for governor. So when he ran again in 1970, he ran to the right, and he didn't say anything racist because he had been an integrationist since he was a kid. But he praised George Wallace and did these sort of dog whistles. Then once he gets in, he becomes the liberal Jimmy Carter that we know today on race, and it's a very dramatic turnaround when he. He puts Martin Luther King's portrait up in the state capitol, and then he goes on the cover of Time magazine as kind of the face of the new South, and that gave him an opening to run for president. He knew he couldn't run for governor again, so that all the people that he offended by being tolerant on race, you know, they wouldn't have a chance to vote him out as governor, because under the Constitution of Georgia, he couldn't run again. He started pretty soon to run for president. He was at 0% in the polls. Nobody gave him any chance at the time that you met him. And, you know, I was in college. I remember him up in New Hampshire, you know, trying to win the New Hampshire primary. It just seemed like such a long shot. But he was running at the right time because his moral message of I'll never lie to you, we need a government as good as its people, this really resonated right after Watergate and the lies of the Vietnam War. And So he was elected almost as a fluke, because the country was moving to the right at the time he was elected, and he was able to hold the South because he was the first Southerner in 140 years to be elected. So, and then the same, you know, post-Watergate press that had helped elect him, they then undid him because they assumed that everything he did was some sort of failure or scandal. When, you know, and they didn't pay attention to the bills that were being signed week after week after week, 14 major pieces of environmental legislation, for instance. And he was changing the country in really very important ways, especially on energy and the environment. And, you know, my book opens with him putting up solar panels on the roof of the White House, which Reagan took down. But that's kind of symbolic of all the things he did to move us toward renewable energy. Protected 105 million acres of wilderness in Alaska that doubled the size of the national park system. And, you know, the first bill on to clean up toxic waste. I could go on and on with the accomplishments that were completely ignored because of the problems that he had. And so I end up describing him, Paul, as a political and stylistic failure, but a substantive and far-sighted success.
And many of the things you just talked about were on my sort of on my notes to talk to you about, things that Reagan got credit for, and how he opened up so many doors, the Middle East and China, and in so many ways that he maybe doesn't get enough credit for. But and I love the fact that you said when he told his mother, Miss Lillian, who we all remember, who were around that day, and said he was going to run for president, she said, "President of what?" So he really took everybody off guard. But here's the thing. Yeah, Carter, you also said, was the first president without any D.C. experience since Wilson. I had kind of forgotten about that. And I guess from there, you pop up to Trump. What is your sense? What is his sense of the effectiveness of a president who doesn't have D.C. experience? Now that he's been there, is it a good thing?
I don't think he would say it's either a good or a bad thing. You know, it depends on the person. So I fastened on that same point, and at one point I was emailing with Jimmy Carter a lot, and I would sort of email him 10 questions, and within an hour he would answer all 10 of them. And so one day I asked him a question. I said, you know, Trump was an outsider, you were an outsider, do you have anything in common with Donald Trump? And he just sent me back a one-word answer: no. You know, because Trump is ignorant, and Carter is one of the smartest people ever to be president of the United States. And, you know, he was like, he likes to read scientific journals in his spare time. And I found some underline from the journal Nature in 1972. He was underlining articles about what was then called, you know, carbon dioxide pollution, you know, climate change. You know, he was reading about it then, and this is what the way he was. His problem was that he never thought of himself as a politician, and so he thought politics was about getting elected, and he didn't really realize that you have to be much more political as president to be successful. So he kept doing these things that were good for the country but were politically costly to him, and in that sense it was similar to Truman. He was totally accountable. He put Truman's "The Buck Stops Here" sign on his desk. And his wife, Rosalynn, would say, you know, can't this wait for a second term? Do you have to do this now? It's going to cost us votes. His advisors would say that, and he'd do it anyway. And he'd actually get kind of annoyed and give you this, what they call the steely blues. He'd stare at you. Instead of blowing his top, he'd just cut you dead. And he could be very cold. You know, if you tried to introduce the politics of an issue into the merits of it, like he wanted to make the right decision, not the political decision. And, you know, it became costly for him, but it also indicated his complexity, because when he was running, he could be very political. And there are just so many layers to Carter that relate to his, you know, his engineering background. Sometimes engineers are not the best leaders. And arguably, Carter was a visionary without being a a genuine leader. Like, he was not the kind of guy, when he charged up the hill, everybody charges up behind him. It was just something about him that didn't generate that level of devotion. And now I think he's beloved. But when he was president, it was much more like Truman. And so I'm trying to do, you know, for Carter, a little bit of what David McCullough did for Truman about 30 years after Truman left the White House. And that is just to begin the reassessment. There will be many other historians who will do this, but it's not just an epic life. And, you know, I mean, I just keep thinking about him dealing with, you know, a local sheriff who used cattle prods on 14-year-old black girls. You know, this was really, really harsh, virulent racism in his town, in his community. And that somehow he's able to kind of transcend all of that, not always covering himself in glory in the process of doing it. And then he has this just amazing journey to human rights, where he's taking the civil rights movement that he had kind of ducked, and he's taking it international with his human rights policy. And this is a really historic policy, even though it was laced with some hypocrisy, in that it was the first time any major power had said that the way other countries treated their own people would be an issue for them. And Carter saved lots of lives when he was president with his human rights policy. And so, you know, there are all these things that kind of got pushed under the carpet as we focused on, you know, his Playboy interview. I cover all that stuff, you know, lust in my heart, or he got attacked by a killer rabbit at one point when he was in a canoe. You know, all these things that happened to him are part of the story, but they sort of pushed aside the not just his core decency, but the actual record, the historical record of how he changed the country and the world.
So many of those points are things I want to ask you about. We only have about 5 minutes left, so so we'll take this little kid whose dad called him Hotshot as he grew up, who's going to become something. But if there were two sentences or whatever, and I might be paraphrasing, John, but that to me sort of summarized Jimmy Carter, maybe summarize your work on him. It was one in which you wrote, he was an unlucky president, but as a candidate, he caught breaks. That to me summarized so much, and I add on to that a quote from Rosalind, which is, a leader leads people where they want to go. A great leader leads where they ought to go. Is it fair to put those two things together and say you kind of have Jimmy Carter in some ways reflected there?
Yeah, I think there's both of those ideas are really central to his story. So, you know, politics involves a lot of luck. And the story of the 1976 campaign, mostly he caught breaks, although he made a lot of his own luck through discipline and preparation. In terms of Rosalind's quote, you know, I don't conclude that Jimmy Carter was a great leader. He's not going to go on Mount Rushmore anytime soon, but he was a consequential leader. And if you want to understand where America is now, you really kind of have to study history. And the history of the 1970s is extraordinarily important for assessing where we are in the 21st century. And he was governor and president in the 70s. And then, you know, in the years since, he's been on the cutting edge of global health and democracy promotion, and of course, you know, housing with Habitat for Humanity. And so I argue, Paul, that he's the only president who effectively lived in three centuries. You know, his life on the farm in the 20s and 30s, it might as well have been in the 19th or 18th century. Then he's part of or connected in some way to all of the major movements of the 20th century. You know, he put more women on the federal bench, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg, than all of his predecessors combined times five. He transformed the federal government in terms of women and African-Americans and Latinos. And then, So that's the 20th century. And then as a former president, he's connected to all the cutting edge issues of the 21st century. So to me, this is an extraordinary American life. And it was so engaging for me to chronicle. And if people have half the pleasure and that from reading the book that I got from the 5 years I spent researching and writing it, I'll be happy.
I'm so glad you mentioned Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because that was on my list to talk about as well. We might not have a Justice Ginsburg if it weren't for Jimmy Carter, who appointed her. And that's one of the points I always like to make about him, too. Trump has completely transformed the judiciary, but I'm pretty sure the last guy to do it in the opposite direction in terms of women and minorities, it was Jimmy Carter.
Right. He had no Supreme Court appointments, which was really bad luck, because he was the first president served a four-year term who did not. But they passed a bill that greatly expanded the federal bench when he was president. So he actually appointed more judges in a four-year period than Trump will, unless he's reelected. And so, yeah, he transformed the judiciary and appointed. There's no question that Ginsburg wouldn't have been on the bench, or it would have been much less likely. And, you know, Ginsburg was often asked, when did you know you wanted to be a judge? And she said, well, I had no idea I could be a judge until Jimmy Carter decided that half the human race had something to contribute. You know, so this was big stuff in terms of changing the face, not just of the judiciary, but of the entire federal government. You know, many of the things that those judges did, some of them are still on the bench. Led to really significant changes in American law. The problem is that a lot of them have retired or died and been replaced by Trump. And so it may be time to do what Congress did in the 1970s and expand the entire court system.
Well, we need to talk again. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But you know, the challenge of Ted Kennedy, the Iranian hostages, and the which probably cost him his job, the economy. He just doesn't get enough credit for some of the things he did do. The book is amazing, though. His very best Jimmy Carter life. It's a read. It's over 600 pages, and I'm so happy that Carter worked with you on it. I know you did interview him over 12 times, and so that means this is authorized, and he is obviously happy with what you did. And it's an incredible work, Jonathan. I congratulate you, and it was also an easy read in that I never got bored. I found myself just wanting to learn more and read more, and it's written in a very readable style, and I thank you for that.
Well, thanks, Paul. I really appreciate it. It is warts and all, and the Carters do like the book, and Walter Mondale was just in touch with me, and he likes the book, but you know, there are certain parts of it that are very personal and even a little painful. So, you know, it was done with his cooperation, but they didn't have any veto power over the book or anything like that. It does contain his love letters, which are very steamy, to Rosalynn when he was in the Navy. And, you know, those are arguably the most explicit letters between a president and first lady in American history.
Until we see Trump's. Well, though, that's a whole other thing. So the book again, his very best Jimmy Carter life, Jonathan Alter. You're one of America's treasures. I thank you for this work, for all the books you've written. FDR, Obama, you've done so many things. Congratulations, and I look forward to the next one that you take up next.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes, and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.